Welcome back to The Edit, Esquire Middle East's leading audio magazine show. What's an audio magazine?
Podcast.
This is an audio magazine, folks. Bits of information that that you really need to know to make you a little bit better in life. Obviously, I am Matthew Baxter Priest, and I am joined here with colleagues Nasri Atala and William Mullally. How are you guys doing?
We're doing well. We have one victim of event season over here. You'll hear it in his voice.
It's a tough morning. There's too many events.
The first has fallen.
Just where were you last night, buddy?
Olympus has fallen.
Or shall I say early this morning?
Good question.
I'm sure that's what your wife asked you.
I was there for half of it, but then I was in bed by midnight.
We were off for Dior. We were at Sushi 99, I want to say, or 99 Sushi, I don't know.
Yeah.
At downtown. It's always nice. I'm amazed by Burj Khalifa. I don't know. I'm just like a tourist. I just always stare up at it like, wow, this thing's really big.
It's really quite tall. Like, honestly, every time I'm like, that is quite tall.
I used to have this thing where it was like, I used to laugh out loud when I'd watch it because I'd look at Burj Khalifa and I'd crane my neck and then crane it again and then realize how you just have to constantly do it when you're at the base of it, which obviously this is the most mundane and obvious thing. But until like you're in that thing, you literally do not do that with any other building on the planet.
It is a very tall building. People are finding out what it's really like to live in Dubai.
The tallest, even.
So, Sushi 99 was where?
That was around in downtown for the Piaget event. Mm-hmm. Fun. There was a nice gig by Abri.
Yeah.
And then there was
our boy Abri.
Yes, our friend. The DJ was Dimitri from Paris, which I think no one had realized. I don't, or maybe no one cares. But for me, as like a fan of like French house clubs of the late 90s, early 2000s. Like Dimitri from Paris being there, I kept telling him, man, you're a legend. I can't believe you're here. No one cared. But it was interesting. I think no one realized who he was.
To qualify, I'm gonna jump in on that.
You guys don't realize.
The full name is Dimitri from Paris.
That's his full name.
That's absolutely fantastic.
And I was with my friend Dimitri who said, I'm Dimitri from Athens.
Nice.
Which was...
nice. Lols. Quiet lols. And then also there was a Dior event last night. Looking at both rough wear. That was at, what was that about, guys? Where was that?
Debuting the Cruise collection for 2023. All women's stuff. So basically we were there
to see our friends wearing Dior. And, you know, life is tough here at Esquire. add laughter track thrown in. Well, good to have you guys back. Glad to see you made it in for the early morning roll call. Let's get on with some news, views, and shoes. Cool. So what has been crossing everyone's inboxes this week? I don't necessarily need everything you've crossed that's crossed mm-hmm. your inbox, but the main one or main story that stuck out for you. Who wants to go first?
So have you heard of the desert kites?
Maybe. Carry on.
So let's say that you were one of the early pilots in the early 20th century flying over the desert for the first time. That's when these things were first spotted. Basically, sure. Pilots were flying over Saudi Arabia and southern Jordan and just being like, what is that kite looking structure? And it was basically these gigantic, sometimes like they went on for kilometers, things that just looked kind of like kites, but no one had any idea what they actually were, what they were for. Just they were this mysterious stone, not obelisk-esque, you know, 2001-esque things off in the desert that really just no one could figure out what they were using until basically now. They've been doing studies in Al Ula, in southern Jordan, even they found some up in Kazakhstan and Armenia, and there are 6,500 that they've found now, which is, they've really been pushing this up in the last 20 years. There were 700 that they'd spotted before, the 6,500, and still more to uncover, all of different shapes and sizes. And it turns out that they were using them as...
Aliens
were really good at hunting, it turns out. Teaching the ancient people of Saudi Arabia, basically, they would scare all these animals into this enclosure. Uh-huh. And then when they got to the end, there was a little trap door. Mm-hmm. So the animals would fall in, and it was just easy pickings. And this it was so effective, apparently, that they probably hunted certain species to extinction just because they would get them in all these things and even change migratory patterns that could... Okay, totally thrown off.
Sorry, someone just walked into the podcast room, so if we've kind of thrown Will off there. It's amazing how people don't read the recording big red
light. I know, I was going to say, like, the big flashing red light outside is... anyway. Yeah,
it's a giveaway. Anyway, sorry, as you were saying.
They even change migratory patterns of certain animals just because they had to avoid them just to survive.
Wow, okay. So, all right, kites, you're meaning the things tied up with string that the wind blows, or kites as in a version of a falcon?
No, a children's kite, just because that was what the structures looked like.
Because they look like kind of triangular or like...
Yeah, they're all different shapes because basically they would create this little like labyrinth. Mm. This was basically the Minotaur was catching these animals inside of these things. So they would just like wander, they'd scare them in this little opening here, then they'd go around this little corner, they'd think that they were home free.
Like a herding funnel.
Yeah.
A hunting herding funnel.
But it's funny, herding like funnel. No one used this technique, like they people kind of forgot about this technique.
Yeah, literally.
Like, I've never heard about this hunting.
It was all like, I think the oldest ones are about 9,000 years old. A lot of the ones they're finding in Al-Ula, that area, in the deserts of the west of Saudi Arabia, are sometimes about 5,000, 3,000, 4,000 years old. So really, I think it was this ancient technique that then totally got forgotten, which is interesting. But it also, I'm sure, was a marker in the development of humanity. And the scientists that have been studying it really said this is a true turning point for people just doing things in a much more organized way, not, you know, wandering around and chasing their prey, but staying in one place, letting things come to them, and just led to, you know, agriculture and development and these early cities that really rose up in the Middle East.
So my question to you is, why has this crossed your inbox?
Yeah, how did you get to
like, the... What's
I always
happened?
Wonder this about what's the stories happened? You like, find. How did you get to...
You got like ancient news getting there? Maybe it's like snail mail, but it's literally taking thousands of years to get to you.
These things just find me. I don't even know at this point. Whether it's an asteroid or it's like a sinkhole in China. My little antenna is tuned for these things.
So to clarify, this is something that you wrote about recently this week that we've just seen a lot of pickup online. Is that the case?
There is a new study that came out... that the Royal Commission of Al-Ula helped commission. Sure. So it does have, you know, a great, you know, regional angle. Al-Ula is obviously coming up in the world. Nasser just came back.
Yes.
Seeing what
I was
going to
say, I think we're going to find out a lot because I was in Al-Ula for the opening of the Banyan Tree Hotel Resort, which is beautiful.
So from old Al-Ula to new Al-Ula.
Yes.
What a transition. Seamless.
It was a very fancy way to be in Al-Ula. But I did go on a tour of like some of these archaeological sites. And what I realized from the tour guide is that actually, for example, there's Dadan, which is where there's like these tombstones carved into the cliff face. And a fascinating place. And he's like, I think last year there was 400 tombs. This year there's 500. So they keep finding like 100 every. They keep finding them.
Right, because they keep finding them.
Yeah,
not creating,
it's not like
right?
Yeah, it's okay, not creating. It's not someone carving
key
them.
Key difference.
But I think because it's only been 10 years or 10 or 15 years that they've been excavating, and if you think of other like archaeological sites, they've been excavated for like 150, 200 years. So I think we're gonna keep finding like a lot of information. And obviously, there's like ancient, like the Nabataeans and whatever. Like these ancient civilizations were there. So I think there's going to be a lot coming out. Like, you'll have much more stories to cover.
No, it genuinely is amazing because people are like, okay. I've basically been explaining it because I went in June because they were filming the first ever Saudi movie there. Mm. And it's basically just like, okay, so you know Petra. Mm. This is the same people. Literally, they would go every single year and build their own tombs and then go back and do their own thing. So it's amazing that this is all just like one interconnected world. Mm-hmm. These borders didn't exist, and this was just these ancient Nabataean people who were just creating these amazing structures and really just flexing on each other all the time. Like,
yeah,
I'm going to have a better thing off here than you are. I'm going to look cooler. I'm going to be remembered. And it's true. We are like, there's one that we take pictures of, and that guy's just winning the game. I don't know if we know his name, but his legacy is complete.
I remember going to Al-Ula in, must have been January this year, so 2022, and seeing Elephant Rock.
Mm.
And not seeing Elephant Rock, seeing the tomb that stands alone, you know.
Yeah.
And I remember taking a picture and sending it to my brother, and he was like, oh, what are you in Petra? And I was like, no, Saudi. But I understand what you're saying. This does look like someone has just crane lifted this rock out of it and just put it in a desert by itself, as in a flex, as in a solid flex of going, I'll make my tomb in this in this standalone rock.
And it's true, but he was Nabataean.
Yeah, fair. Yeah. So less Nabataean, more Albanian. What were you doing? Well, I know the answer to this, but why don't you tell our audience a little special treat that you had while you were out there?
Yeah, so there was a little private Mariah Carey concert. Which, I mean, even those words are crazy.
I mean, little Mariah Carey.
It was, I mean, yeah, it's, I was sitting, you know, about as far from her as I am from you. Like, it was kind of crazy to witness that. And I was sitting next to Allison, who's a colleague of ours here, and she was like, she knew every word to every. She was reliving her teenage years. It was really nice, actually. I think she gave me a lot of energy. Like,
this is Allison from Grazia.
Yeah, exactly. And so we just, I don't know, I felt like I was 15 again. I don't know, it just took me back, basically. And we got to meet her after it was a little meet and greet with Mariah Carey. Again, crazy words to be saying. And yeah, I mean, what do you say to Mariah Carey?
What do you say to Mariah Carey?
Well, I said, thank you, that was great. I don't know, which sounds, again, very stupid now. I did shout out, I love you, Mariah, a few times, which no one was really like laughing at. So I was like, okay, maybe I should stop.
Did you even love Mariah, or did you just fall in love with Mariah in that moment?
I definitely, honestly, yeah, I would say like I didn't go in with very strong Mariah. I mean, obviously Mariah is part of the atmosphere. Like, you know, you can't not love Mariah Carey, but like after the gig, I think, yeah, like newfound respect for, like, she's funny. She's on top of things. She's changed her songs to fit her voice she's 53 now. So her vocal range has changed, and she's changed her songs, like the arrangements. I don't know, it's just really like special.
And I'm sure, I heard it's like meeting the queen as well.
Yeah, I mean,
Queen Mariah.
Queen Mariah.
This is our, now that, you know.
There's only one queen.
Queen Elizabeth is gone. We have Mariah. This is what
What's funny is the venue is called Mariah as well, which, and she made a little joke on that. But, she's not as intimidating as I thought she would be. Like, it was actually, I mean, I don't think I shook her hand. Right? I just like stood like, you don't kind of, it is like the queen. Like, you don't touch her. You don't like grab her.
You bow.
I might have like did a little nod, you know, like a.
I also don't think you should be just touching strange women. Either way.
But no, I mean like putting my hand out to say, to shake hands. But yeah, no, it was a nice moment.
Yeah, absolutely.
But the ins and outs of Alula, checking every week for Alula News. Honestly, there's stuff popping up like mad over there, especially with the upcoming new seasons. They've got that roller rink thing with Swizz Beatz.
Did
everyone catch that news?
I did not.
Just so like Swizz Beatz, obviously the producer and also occasionally known as the husband of
Alicia Keys.
Alicia Keys, although most people refer to him like that. You know, he's his own guy. Although Alicia is also number one. But yeah, apparently he came over to open like a desert roller skating rink. There was a pop-up, I believe.
I heard about that.
One of the most remote roller skating rinks in the world, but that sounded like a an Instagram favorite. Let's put it that way.
It's a crazy place. It's a really special, I found it very, reminded me of Iceland, which, I mean, obviously it doesn't like look anything like Iceland, but just like the remoteness, the quiet in the morning, the feeling that you're somewhere like a bit otherworldly, it really, I definitely want to go back.
I like that it's still a bit unrefined too. Mm. You know, like everyone there is just Saudi and they have not spent their entire life in hospitality. And as much as we love the people that have been, you know, trained in Switzerland,
yeah,
it's also cool to feel like you're actually going to a place and it's not just a bunch of people who are imported who are amazing at taking care of every single aspect of it. It's like, okay, this is what people here are actually like.
And they're like genuinely excited. Like I realize like the people, you know, who were like welcoming you at the hotel or like giving you the tour, like everyone's either from Alula or from like nearby, from Medina or something, and they're like really excited to just see people coming and enjoying the country. And I think that was like special. Like it was nice to like just see how excited they were.
I'm gonna flip on that. I need my luxury, like, at least, like I need like some 7-star luxury at all times.
I'm enjoying terrible service. You're just like, no.
Yeah, I'm going. I'm just like, if my bath is not like made from like a
rose petals,
and fizzy water, sparkling water bath, that's what I need. But speaking of which, I'll close out this section with some actual shoe news, which is you know, the name is in jest, but this is actually a real thing. There was We recently heard that Farfetch, the e-com site, launched the latest addition to their Farfetch Beat. I suppose it's more of a retail concept that they do, where they bring in different brands and collaborate with them to do something and then sell it limited edition uniquely on their website. And this is one that really kind of picked our ears up here at Esquire, because it was about a luxury shoe safe. So, you know, you get safes for your watches, for your jewels, I don't know, do people still have money bags of like cash?
Like
you know,
the old burglars.
You're just gold bars in your safe. Surely you got gold bars.
I think
bars
that's probably, Demna is releasing that for Balenciaga 2024. 100%.
Need to be hidden behind like an oil painting of himself. Lovely stuff. But anyway, it's a shoe safe. Now, it's one of those things that I didn't realize should exist, and now I realize that it does exist. It's the only thing I want to get.
A shoe safe. How many shoes does it fit?
So they are customizable.
Okay.
They basically this collaboration between Stadium Goods, who are, you know, the kind of the premium sneaker wear and streetwear online marketplace, mm-hmm. and a German safe manufacturing brand called Dirtling. Mm-hmm. Correct me if I'm saying that wrong, but I think that's right. It's got an umlaut on it. All the umlauts.
There you go.
And yeah, basically, it's a luxury line of made-to-measure sneaker safes where you can basically choose from having the outside in calf leather, faux ostrich, faux alligator, faux cowhide. The setup's the same. They're limited to 15 per, I don't know, pelt or per material. But they will not be cheap.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Anyone want to fancy a guess on this in an Arab Emirati dirhams?
100,000.
Nazari is close to that. In fact, really? Actually, wow. put your ones together. It's 120K.
Oof. Really?
But I mean, you know.
How much are the sneakers that go in there?
I mean, if you've got like some baller sneakers, you know, some real will. Kind of.
Yeah,
Premier League sure level sneakers, then you want to keep that stuff safe, or you want to keep it in an easily movable case where you can lose all of them at once. But I believe there is a lot of technology in it. There's things like a specified ID on it. There might be biometrics in there as well, because Dirtling don't mess around. They make professional safes, so I'm sure that they've added all that. And for that price, I'm certainly sure they do. So
crazy.
For climate too, like has to be a big thing. Like keeping those shoes just actually able to survive.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Like humidors. But that's a thing. I mean, I don't know why I'm so obsessed with luggage at the moment. I was recently reading up on how like LeBron did a collaboration with Rimowa.
I like that collection. Yeah.
Yeah, I think he basically made luggage for bottles of
grape, saw that
whatever we call that vintage bottles, let's put it that way. I mean, luggage, it's sexy, tell me I'm wrong.
We debuted that collection on Esquire. We did.
It was a good looking one.
The LeBron photos when they announced the collection.
Yeah, but like a travel case for your 12 pack.
No.
I honestly believe that the new runway is the conveyor belt at the
airport.
Everyone's looking for who's got the luggage and who's wearing what and who's traveling on what. And it's a whole thing. I'm like a massive people watcher. So like conveyor belts waiting for baggage, that's like a gold mine.
I love my hand luggage. It's Horizon Studios. And basically it has a pouch for your laptop. It's like the perfect thing. Like all you need is that rolly thing. Yeah. And it has a charger. It has a pouch for your passport. It's like I love it because it just makes my life so much easier. And it's in a beautiful military green, which I love.
Yeah, well, if you want more, you're going to post a picture of that up on your social media so people can follow it. Right, guys, thanks for the news, views, and shoes. We'll be back after this brief break. So we are back and discussing something that's very dear to all three of our hearts. It is the fact that the TV show The Bear is now out in the region on Disney Plus. And we're going to talk a little bit about the season one, and there might be a little surprise at the end. Well, why don't you kick us off?
Yeah, honestly, I think The Bear is one of those shows that went from a cult show that you had to tell your friends about to the show that everyone in the world was talking about within about a week, it seems. It's like it debuted to no fanfare in June. I don't think they had any expectations for it. It's created by one of the writers and directors of Atlanta, who basically his sister is a chef, and he was just like, okay. He's also a friend with this guy, Maddie Matheson, who's a chef, who's got shows on Viceland, et cetera. And they'd been talking about this idea for years, we should do a show based around how kitchens really are, how chefs really are, because nothing seems to really get it. There are like a lot of like chef movies and things like this, but really I don't think anything had ever captured it to the spirit of The Bear. Honestly, it's like reading Anthony Bourdain's Kitchen Confidential. Mm. It captures a lot of not only, the extreme stress, but also the types of people who can survive in that sort of extreme stress, the different wayward personalities that survive in that world, who often, have to abuse their own bodies and minds and souls in order to survive it. And also, you know, and end up coming out as a great found family on the other side. It creates this, you know, great little society of people who exist in that world, and they only really understand each other, and you only understand it unless you've been in it. And, you know, from all of my friends who have lived in that world, I think The Bear captures it better than anything else. But even if you've never worked in a kitchen, you don't know anything about food, it's just a really easy watchable show. It's just about this this young guy who's, you know, had a brother who ran a restaurant who wouldn't let him work in his restaurant. So he's like, all right, forget you. I'm going to go to New York. I'm going to become the best chef of all time. He goes and works in the best restaurant in the world. His brother dies and leaves him the restaurant in his will. And so he quits his job, moves back to Chicago, decides to run this, you know, beef Italian sandwich shop that's run down and no one has any idea what to do. It's out of money, but he's decided he's going to make it something great. And we watch him struggle and somewhat succeed as the 8 episodes roll on.
Yeah, it's a fascinating show. I went through that exact journey that you're explaining. You know, not really expecting much, but maybe it was the grittiness. Maybe it was just the what I want to know from you guys or why are we so obsessed with food as kitchens. A culture? Why are we so obsessed with food and kitchens and the culture there? I mean, as you said, there's only a tiny percentage of people that actually live that life. But it seems so voyeuristic and so fly on the wall relatable. Do we look at it going, I'm glad that's not us? Or do we look at it almost envious of the passion that chefs have for creating something?
Yeah, I think there's been, I mean, you mentioned Anthony Bourdain. Well, like, there's been this like mythologization, like around, or myth making around chefs in the last, I would say, like, I don't know.
20 years?
20, 30 years where they've become like rock stars. And I think that adds like a fascination. And obviously the show's like Top Chef and stuff. So like we've become obsessed with like understanding how food functions. But we've also seen it in a way that's very glamorized. Whereas I think in The Chef, The Bear, it's not glamorized at all. It's like it feels tight. Like when you're in the kitchen with them, like it feels claustrophobic. You feel, and they keep like, you know, they keep saying behind, because when they pass behind each other.
Which I now do in my house.
I say yes, that. Chef, to everyone.
Honestly, me and the girlfriend's like, every time I walk behind, I'm just like, behind. Like, could be cooking, could be nothing. Like,
but it's, I think.
It's good practice.
I think that like the feeling that the show gives you is like you, like even when they step outside into the alleyway to have a cigarette, like you can smell the alleyway. I don't know, there's just something so visceral about the show. And yeah, it's like the fact that, for example, the guy who starts to make the cake and tries to get this cake perfect, like the pastry chef basically. Like you can, and there's also this like mismatch between where they are and where they want to be. Like they all want to be in the kitchen he's just come from basically, but they're in this like neighborhood. Actually, they don't all, like I think half of them want to be in that fancy kitchen and half of them just want to get on and like, yeah, just do this job and go home and don't care. And that's the interplay that's really interesting. I think also it's like invisible labor. Like we don't get to go into these kitchens really. And like your food just arrives at your table and you're like, my food emerged from somewhere. And like being in there and seeing like how many people are making this happen and the clockwork of it and the military, you know, that yes, chef, you know, that like almost like hierarchical military structure is really interesting to see.
Yeah, you got to like chain James Corden down to a chair and be like, see, stop being mean. Yeah. Look at what these poor people are doing for you. Yeah.
He's banned from this allegedly. Podcast as well, by the way.
Yeah, there you go.
Just while we're at it. But I think you nailed something there, Naz. I think you said it's that element where you can smell the kitchen, you can feel the tension. And I think nothing holds that better than there's one specific episode. And I want to say it's, correct me if I'm wrong here, Will, but I want to say it's episode 7. And I know we've got a clip lined up of you. I recently spoke to someone particularly about that.
Yeah, so Matty Matheson, who was, as I was saying, friends with the creator ahead of time. He's this, you know, great chef who's I was speaking to just as he's about to launch his new Italian restaurant in Toronto. And he wasn't much of an actor, but he came in to be a consultant, to show them how things really are, to create this atmosphere. And then in episode 7, they basically... So the episode starts with everything falling apart. And we survive with them for 20 minutes as they try to figure out how they can solve this, how they can keep their kitchen functioning as everything's falling apart.
It's so stressful.
It's incredibly stressful. It is all one shot.
Yeah.
And, you know, for I think Maddie, it was an amazing experience as someone who's never really been around a set to watch this unfold and to watch them do it in only two takes.
Wow.
Like, he's like, Jesus. We were out by noon that day. They what? Just two takes, he told me.
You know,
me.
I was talking about that episode with my friend Tanya Marar. We wrote a thing about her. She was a camera operator on House of the Dragon. Mm. And when she watched that episode, she sent, because we were talking about one take, famous one take shots or episodes yep. or films. And she sent
true,
me, she's
true
like,
true detective.
She's what? Like, how did they do it? She was texting me, she's like, I don't know how they, it was amazing. How did they do that? Like, it was, and it, to know that they did it in two takes is really annoying.
Yeah, yeah. So, honestly, like, they'd already, like, sent me a little, like, rap thing because we were talking on Zoom. So I'm getting, like his representatives are sitting there in the chat, like, please stop talking. And he's just like, no, I need to tell you about episode 7. I'm just like, okay, I'm going to get in trouble. Tell me everything. I need to know how this actually went down.
Cool. Let's hear a clip.
Like, how long did that take to film? Because obviously it's all one shot. How many times did you guys have to do it?
That was take two.
That was take two.
Take two.
What messed up on take one?
We were done. Well, we had to get two. The we were done by noon that day.
Wow.
It was crazy. We just like ran, like it was just thing. Like we would set up and like it was 20 minutes. So it was like we did we ran it a couple times, you know. We didn't run it more than enough because it was just like. It became too rehearsed. Hmm. And so Chris was like, we're good. And we're like, okay, go home. See you soon. You know, like it was a great, like, it was just like, yeah, I believe that it was, it was like take two, you know, by like 9 a.m. We were like, that was it. We got it. You know, it was crazy.
Well, you guys did get it. I think the world has agreed. Absolutely.
Yeah. Like it was a thing. Like it was like, everyone rehearsed. And I was just like, One like funny, like I was just like, I can't have lines. I was like, I can't f this up. I was like, I'll be in it. Like I even was like, I don't really necessarily need to be in it. Really, I do like a walk, you know, like I'm just kind of there and I do like a walk by. And I was just like, all of these actors are such serious actors and they're so good. I was just like, I can't be the person to like f this up. And like, if I look at them and make them smile or like, cause sometimes I'll like just look at them and like, I would like break Jeremy. Like sometimes he'd just start like laughing at me. He's like, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm staring at you. You know, like, I was just like, I can't help myself. I'll like laugh or something. I was just like, I'm just going to do, I was like, don't write me in this fucking thing. And that was my one like thing. I was like, honestly, I do not want to speak in that episode. I just want to be in it and do a thing.
That was great. Once again, people can watch The Bear and watch that awesome episode 7 that we've just discussed. You can watch it on Disney Plus. It's available now. Okay, so welcome back to the final segment of the show. It is called, as always, Strong Opinions Loosely Held. Now, normally, I am the guy who will have a rather firm opinion on things, and it's up for you guys to kind of talk me down from it. But we're going to mix it up this week. So does anyone else have something that they want to bring up?
I have a strong opinion.
Oh.
My strong opinion is that it is generally a disappointment for fashion that Yeezys will no longer be for sale. Apart from the fact that Kanye West has obviously shot himself in the foot by just continuing to be a terrible person in public. Honestly, I think all these brands seem to have been getting really strong influence from him for a long, long time in a way that is interesting. You know, he kind of made slides a thing again, and now you're watching all the other brands have their take on it, find a way to make this a thing. Same with the foam runners. We saw them at first, and it's like, this is disgusting, and now it's turned into something that is affecting the way that other people are doing really interesting things with. And now what are we going to go back to? Just ripping off Jordans from the 80s and Reeboks from the early, you know, 90s and this New Balances from, I don't want this. Come on. I want like the weird, whatever, like he basically, you know, got Stephen Smith, who made like all these like great New Balances in the late 80s and early 90s, had him do the weirdest possible things. And it was cool. And I couldn't wear a lot of it because I would look ridiculous, but I'm happy that it existed. And I'm sad that it's not going to anymore.
It's an interesting thing. I was in Paris a couple of weeks ago speaking to someone about that, and it was when Kanye had just what was the last Paris Fashion Week, so when he was with Balenciaga. And it was I was in a conversation with someone at dinner, and I remember saying, it's like, I love the level of like give a shtick like that Kanye has, where it's like a point where it's unvetted. It's just pure, like, he feels that there's his level of fame is so elite that there's no censor, no check.
Mm.
But then literally the flip side of that was what we saw this week where, you know, when there is an element where you feel that you can say anything, you don't fact check it. You don't realize the damage and the that basically opinion can sometimes be putrid and it can be so kind of destructive and it can be so counterproductive. So it's funny that we saw that in such a quick, well, not Kanye, it's not been a quick turn, but it has been this level of, again, the ability to be honest to someone's individual thoughts is so rare these days because everything is marketed and spun and pushed out there. And, but obviously, then you immediately see the downside of that of realizing that not every thought is needed for all ears.
Yeah, it's a tricky one because obviously there's things he said that are terrible, most recently, and then there are things that he said in the past that are not as terrible, but like just weird. And then there's things that he's right on. And then, so obviously like it's complex, but then, and he's been kind of, you know, not used by some brands, but like it's mutually beneficial until it's not. And I don't know, it's a very because now I've seen people like share like Team Kanye and I'm like, oh, that's a weird thing to say today. But I guess overall I understand it, but like these views are bad, but like you were saying, like he's done stuff. I don't know. It's very. I find these things very hard to have an opinion about. Besides the, you know, like oh, those words are bad, but this person, I don't know. I find it more. It's like having an uncle with these views. You
is
know,
it,
like
is it canceling the art? For canceling the artist doesn't cancel the art, I suppose.
Well, Will's for a lot of people, Aziz.
I mean, but I also know people like in this office who are now saying like, okay, I need to go buy three more pairs of shoes because I can no longer wear that three pairs of shoes in my rotation. So for a lot of people, this is it. Like his streaming numbers have plummeted. So for a lot of people, they will not separate it. That's it.
Sure.
Like they can't have this anymore. But honestly, I don't know. I can't. It does feel like, yeah, the mental health is a key issue here. It does feel like he's just, we know that he has these issues. We know that he probably is just on an episode and it's probably more sad than anything else. And the dude, like, so I don't know how like deeply held his opinions might be, but I do know that probably this is a manifestation of something more troubling.
Yeah. Like it doesn't excuse the views he has. Cause like, you know, mental health doesn't make you have these views, but, or like mental health problems doesn't make you have these views, but I have a problem with the people who keep having him on their podcasts and like, he's clearly not well. I have people in my life who are bipolar. I know how it is. And you just don't put people in a position where they can dig this grave for themselves if you care about them. And that's what I've been, you know, having a problem with is how much people want him, like, you know, for just for clout. Mm. Oh, I'll get him on the podcast. He said yes. And like, let's get him to say some crazy stuff. And that's what I have more. I mean, obviously don't like his views on the what he said in the last week and other stuff in the past. But I just think it's not right to keep putting him in a place where he can keep voicing them.
Yeah, and it does feel like, I mean, he was basically, before he started saying the worst of what he's been saying, is basically he feels exploited. Like everyone's just using him for their own gain, spitting him out. He feels like this happens to people from the black community, you know, a lot more than it happens to everyone else. He felt it happened to his friend Virgil. We saw him like publicly deal with the, you know, the fact that they had this great falling out, even though they'd kind of come up with this concept of democratizing fashion in the late 2000s. And for a lot of parts, we're doing that and like working towards that. But, you know, I think ultimately he was kind of right. And I think a lot of times the people that are so easy to reject everything that he's ever done and treat him as if this is, you know, a red line they couldn't cross when they don't use other people that have crossed that exact same red line the same way, we're kind of just looking for an excuse to get rid of somebody they already hated. And ultimately, or they're exploiting him for their own gains, or that's just like a reaffirmation of something that they already believed. And so it's just all around sad for me, just in a lot of different ways. And I obviously, yeah, none of this is about like condoning the awful hate that he spewed, because, you know, obviously these things shouldn't happen, but you know, there is, I think, a lot going on here that is worth to be discussed. We're probably going to be hashing out for a long time to come.
Sure. Well, as I said, it's a multifaceted thing, which we will continue to cover and unpack over the kind of years that it rolls out. That's why we're here.
But somebody's got to do it.
Yeah, exactly. But guys, thank you for your time this week. And I think, guys, thanks for listening. Did you guys want to get your plugs in before we go? Where can people find you on social media and things?
At WH Mullally, four L's, cross my, all the L's.
Four L's.
LOL.
I love that.
LOL.
Nasri Atala, NASRIATALLAH. Two L's. How many L's? Anyway, so on Twitter. Let's do Twitter this week.
Cool. And I'm at Mr. Pika on all social media. Also, we are all available, and you can see everything coming out on Esquire ME and Esquire Middle East. Or check out the website. It's all good readings if you like what you heard today. We're around. Get in touch with us. Hit us up individually or collectively. Other than that, have a good week, guys.
Cheers. Peace.